Thanks, Benny. And thank you all for coming. It's really nice to be back in Waterloo. It's been a little while, but Perimeter is always fun. And actually, I realized this morning that I gave my first ever seminar in this room as an undergrad many years ago. So it's kind of nostalgic. It might even be the same hockey stick. So today I'll be telling you about some work with Jordan Kotler, Patrick Hayden, who's my advisor, Brian Swingle, and Michael Walter. And the talk is, as you can see here, it's got a little bit of ADS-CFT, at least in the title. And since this is a quantum info seminar, at least I think, I tried to split the difference. Assuming there'd be people from both sides, we'll try to keep it sufficiently general. And in the abstract, I advertised a little bit that I wanted to drive across a point that quantum error correction is useful, and I said I would give some examples. So figured I would take the opportunity to just show you a sampler, at least of things in our group, so a bit of a shameless plug where this is true. And I apologize in advance, this is going to be extremely fast. You might not get anything out of this slide, but I'll make a point at the end. And I really just wanted to kind of whet your appetite for these things. So if something I say is confusing or particularly interesting, I strongly encourage you to come talk with me at the end. Right, so quantum error correction seems to be very useful in a number of scenarios. And I'll just give, again, a couple of examples. So there's a protocol we call information replication. The idea here is that you want to be able to distribute some quantum information, some state, in a known configuration of regions in space-time. And in this particular configuration, those regions are these black lines, which are null lines. They're light-like segments of volumes in space-time. And if you're asked to distribute the same state in all of those regions without cloning, it kind of looks impossible, given the geometry. And the way you can actually do it is with quantum error correction. So you encode your state phi into an error-correcting code that has the property that given any two of the three, you can decode it. And if you have only one, you have a maximally mixed state. So doing that, you then send those shares. I'm ruining my animations. You send those shares to the original, into those space-time volumes, and then transport them in a known way to their neighbors. And in doing that, what ends up happening is that each space-time volume sees two of those three shares of the code and has access to the information in some way that I've made completely imprecise here. But the point that I want to get across here is that quantum error correction is letting you do something that would have naively seemed impossible. And so you can ask me about it later. Something else that seems to come up, quantum error correction is often used for talking about qubits, for doing information processing in computers or something like that. But you could instead talk about quantum error correction for less abstract quantities that transform as you, say, change a basis or something. Things that are intimately coupled to the physics of the implementation. And it turns out that question is equivalent to trying to do covariant quantum error correction, where everything that Alice and Bob do in their lab has to be covariant with respect to some symmetry, has to commute with the symmetry. And it turns out then that actually there's a no-go theorem that you can't quite do this, that if Alice and Bob are using finite dimensional quantum systems and the symmetry they care about is a continuous one, then there are no covariant quantum error correcting codes in that scenario. And an alternative, or I guess a way of getting around this no-go theorem is if you use infinite dimensional systems, then actually you can do this. And a corollary of this result is that you can get around the Easton-Knill theorem using continuous variable systems or infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Completely out of left field then, now let's just change gears. Suppose you were considering three-dimensional manifolds, Euclidean manifolds, and on top of those manifolds is a Chern-Simons theory. If you insert Wilson loops and compute the Euclidean path integral, that gives you a state. And you can ask, what kinds of states can I prepare in this way? What class of states? And it turns out that if the theory is a U1 level K Chern-Simons theory, that set of states exactly coincides with the stabilizer states. So somehow, living underneath all this machinery is quantum error correction, and it just comes out naturally. And finally, there's this. It seems as though quantum error correction is deeply important in quantum gravity, or at least holographic theories of quantum gravity, but I'm talking about that a little bit more today, so I'll postpone. So again, the point that I want to get across is that error correction seems to be fantastically useful, comes up everywhere, lets you do things you might not have thought possible otherwise, and that you shouldn't just think of it as something that is only applicable to computing or just as a formal subject, but that it can actually help you in other physical systems. So If there are any pressing questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, please ask me later. Okay. Good. So then let's talk about the fourth one over there, holography. So the idea that we're going to have in mind is we're going to be working within the context of ADS-CFT. And the main question is that you have two theories that are dual to one another, and you want to know which quantities in one of those are dual to the other two quantities in a reduced subregion of the other. And I'll make that precise in a second. But for those of you who already are familiar with all of these terms, what we're going to do is we're going to prove the entanglement wedge reconstruction hypothesis robustly, find an explicit formula for it, and we do this using some recent results in quantum info on universal recovery channels, and we generalize those a little bit. So let's start with recovery, this result. So who Yale uses. So suppose I give you a classical stochastic map, P of y given x, and an observation of the output, y. Then your goal is to find another map, another stochastic map, so something within the same class of objects, that lets you kind of reverse this one and get back your initial state. You might have thought, well, maybe I can use the inverse of P of y given x, but that might not exist. And you thought, maybe I can, and if it does exist, maybe it's not another stochastic map. So within this constrained problem, you have to find it. And I guess I already gave the answer away in the title. It comes from Bayes' rule. So here what we do, Bayes' rule tells you how to do this. It gives you P of x given y. And so if you think of this initial object as a channel, use your quantum intuition, think of this as a channel, and this is an input state, then you can just check that Bayes' rule, taking the other channel, this thing that Bayes' rule gives you, and sticking in the output, gives you back the input. So Bayes' rule is kind of a classical way of doing this recovery. Now, for no reason other than I know where I'm going with this, I'm just going to trivially rewrite this. So this seems like something you would never want to do, but I'll give you a second to just do this derivative in your head, right? You get 1 over this times this, and then set t to 0. So that's just Bayes' rule, and I've just written it in a weird way. And I won't tell you why I'm doing that for a few slides. So put that on ice, and we'll come back to it. So here was the classical case. Let's try to do the quantum case. So now instead of a stochastic map, you're given a quantum channel, n. And your goal is to find another quantum channel that reverses the original one. It gives you back the input. So that if you had some state rho and you've computed n of rho, you want to take this output state and act on that with your new map that you find to get back your input. That's the goal. Well, it turns out that an important quantity to consider here is relative entropy, which I'll just remind you is a measure of distinguishability. And the reason this turns out to be important is because relative entropy satisfies this monotonicity inequality. And what this is telling you is that a quantum channel cannot increase distinguishability between states. All it can do is decrease distinguishability, or at best it can leave it the same. But suppose it does leave it the same. Suppose you saturate that inequality. Then it means that n, in some sense, the channel n, is not losing any information. And so that kind of gives a hint that you can be able to undo it, since you're not throwing anything away. So let's pull that thread a little bit. So here was the monotonicity of relative entropy inequality. And we're going to see what happens when you saturate it. So now this is an equality, and I'm going to emphasize this is a very strong condition. We're saying suppose your quantum channel satisfies this equation. That's a strong condition on the channel n. Well, what do you know about n in that case? It turns out that actually, if n satisfies this equation, then it's reversible in the following sense. It means that there's another map, one of these recovery things that I've got in the upper corner. There exists one of these maps that lets you come back to the input. So in particular, there exists some map, P now instead of R for the reason I'll make clear in a sec, that lets you recover your input state from the output state. And that's true for all states in the domain that we care about. And the reason I'm calling it P is because this is called the Petz map, after Petz, who found it. And he gave an explicit form for this map here. Okay, so a couple of things to notice about this. First, so notice here that the way it's written, it's indexed by two quantities. One is n, the channel, and that sort of makes sense, that the recovery map for n should depend on n, Because if not, that's too strong a thing to ask. You're asking for too much. But it also depends on a particular state sigma. And you're free to choose that state. So there's a one parameter family of these PETS maps, of these recovery maps, indexed by the state sigma. And once you choose a particular state, it gives you a particular map. But you could have chosen any other state that you care about, and all of these maps act the same way on the code, on what I'll now start calling the code space, and they may look different off the code space. And you can check really quickly. Let's say, okay, so suppose you now fix your favorite state sigma, some reference state. We call this the reference state. And choose an output state n of sigma. Suppose you take this output state and feed that into your recovery map. So you have an n of sigma here. And it's not too hard to see that n of sigma cancels with these two, and you get an identity inside the brackets. And n dagger of the identity is the identity, so you end up with just sigma. So this one is easy. You can easily just check that. This one's a little bit harder. It's not obvious. Even still, once you've fixed a sigma, choosing any other state n of rho and putting that in here will give you back rho. That's a remarkable thing. Okay, and I'll point out, so this, again, I emphasized that this is a very strict, very strong condition. Things that, channels n that satisfy this, here are some examples. Unitaries will do this, because unitaries preserve angles, and so they don't destroy any information, and so you can always find a recovery channel for the unitary, it's just conjugate by the adjoint. Other examples of channels n that do this are quantum error correcting codes. If you encode and then subject your output state to some noise, the point of error correction is that you can still get back your initial state. And so there exists one of these recovery maps, and we call it the decoder in that case. But again, this is a very strong condition, and it gives you back your initial state exactly. That's why we call this exact recovery, because this is exactly saturated, and you get back your initial state exactly. But what if you didn't care so much? You say, well, I'm easygoing. Just give me a state that's close. I'm fine with some epsilons. Then it turns out that actually you can do this approximately. So you might hope, well, say I want to do this again, I apply my recovery map, but all I really care about is that I get close to my initial state. Give me some epsilon, it's okay. Then thanks to these guys down here, this group of people, a very nice paper, turns out that for any quantum channel, and I mean for any quantum channel n, there always exists one of these recovery maps such that you can recover your initial state approximately. And how approximately? I have to quantify this for you. Well, that's what this equation says. It turns out actually that the degree to which you are able to get back your initial state depends on how well the channel n saturates this monotonicity of relative entropy equation. So let's see here. This boxed equation says that the left-hand side is essentially monotonicity of relative entropy. It says how much does n change the distinguishability between two states? And the right-hand side, let's unpack it a little bit. F is the fidelity between two states. The right-hand side is measuring the fidelity between rho, the input, and r of n of rho, the output. Okay, so this is telling you that the amount by which you are able to get back to your initial state is controlled by how well the channel saturates monotonicity of relative entropy. Not only did they prove that these exist and that inequality is true, they gave an explicit formula for it. So just as in the exact case, we had this PETS map here, we have something similar in the approximate case, and it looks familiar because it is taking the PETS map and you twirl it. This is a twirled PETS map, and that's what it's called. Okay, so let me pause for questions.
This new recovery map is going to saturate that inequality in the map, by looking in the box.
This one here?
Yeah.
No, so it says that for some channel n, there's always a recovery map, and this is a choice of recovery map. Uh-huh. This inequality will always be true, and this I think this recovery map here is optimal, but it's not necessarily going to saturate this. Actually, wait, does it saturate? Okay, now I actually don't remember if it saturates that one, but it's certainly an optimal choice. Okay.
Yeah, I'm also confused. So what is the condition here, we are assuming that what's the flow of the logic code?
Of these qualifiers? Okay, so for all CPT maps N, there exists a CPT map R such that this is true. So actually, it's very general. It just says pick your favorite quantum channel.
Okay.
There's always another one that does this, and the quality of this approximate sign here is given by is controlled by the left hand side. So it says that the fidelity between the input and output is lower bounded by how well you saturate monotonicity. Okay.
If it's not saturated, can you tell me something about why this is optimal or how it's optimal?
I think I think I just don't remember actually the result. I think it might saturate it. But I should check. I will check this.
Okay.
I mean, it's something. It's I just need to check.
Is it exprimed really in terms of a series by deforming the contour? You get something.
I missed the start of the question. So
it's formed an integrated contour, and there is beta of just zeros and poles. So doesn't get another formula by the
So yeah. So okay, so let me just remember now. This beta does it have?
Okay.
I'm not sure that it does. Right, so so here, let me show you.
No.
No, it's okay. I mean, I have it here. So this is beta.
Yeah,
in the complex plane. Sorry.
But that's okay.
Okay, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about this. Okay, good. So then, all right. So I started by talking about Bayes' rule. Let's see where that comes up now. Here's the PETS map again. Start with just the exact PETS map. And let's make everything classical. So if everything's classical, it means that your states just become, diagonal probability distributions. And the channel, everything's Hermitian, and everything commutes. So write out the PETS map. Everything commutes past everything else. And then using these identifications, you just get Bayes' rule. So PETS map reduces to Bayes' rule in the classical case. So in some sense, it's a non-commutative version. But I had this weird rewriting that we put on ice. So here it is. So let's thaw this out again. So here's that strange rewriting. And let's try to see what happens in the approximate case. So take that approximate universal recovery map, the one with the integral, and compute its choice state. And if you don't remember the choice state of a map of a quantum channel, you find by acting with the channel on one half of a maximally entangled state or an unnormalized maximally entangled state. And that gives you a density matrix that's isomorphic to the channel. And if you don't remember seeing that, I mean, you might have seen it in this context where, suppose this is a unitary, if you just bend the legs out to make them output legs, what you're doing here is exactly the same thing. It's a state that's isomorphic to the map. You're computing its choice state. Right, so what we do is we compute the choice state of the universal of this integrated approximate recovery map, and this is what you find. So the calculation is not hard; it's just a few lines. But this is what you get, and you'll notice the similarity. So we would say that this is the fully general quantum analog of Bayes' rule. And what it's kind of strange. I don't have an intuition for what you're doing, but you're perturbing this weird combination of input and output states in the direction of the channel. And looking at the response of that, somehow that is the recovery map. Yeah.
What is the bar in top of the N?
This bar is just complex boundary.
And what's the star next to the second N?
That is also like the complex conjugate. It's just that this is now a channel, so it is a type of conjugate. It's just not the adjoint.
So this is the universal recovery channel.
That's right.
If you just looked at the PETS recovery channel, could you have written it in such a form?
We use, let me go to these, this again.
If you'd taken like the classical expression for P of Y, put in n of sigma, and for p of x, put in sigma inverse, or?
I mean, actually, yeah, I guess you could. You could also use the Petz map like this. It would just, yeah, because at least on the code space, the approximate Petz map in the, if you start with the, sorry, if you, yeah, if you start with the universal recovery map, and you compute that for a channel that does saturate monotonicity, I think it reduces to the regular Petz map on the code space. So I guess it would be the same.
You say you had a function beta of t in the channel.
Yeah.
Where does it appear here?
Interesting. So it appears here. So this is just an identity. It's just an identity. And it turns out that if you have just two matrices or something, A and B, that you can write this logarithmic derivative in this way, and that beta is the same one that appears there. So it goes away in writing in somehow in the log. OK. Good. More questions?
Why is that rewriting is nice?
Why is it nice?
There are infinitely many
rewritings. No, I agree. Because this at least in this way, it looks like Bayes' rule in some sense. But hold that thought. If you're still around, I guess you might have to leave. But at least in the ADACT context, it makes things look nicer. Okay. So one other thing we did was the following. So everything I said there was for quantum channels defined between Hilbert spaces, and you just have, you have your qubits or something like this. It can be infinite dimensional, but that's okay. So now what we did was we proved the following little lemma. We said, suppose you instead just start with two finite dimensional von Neumann algebras of observables, and you compute you have their individual state spaces, and there's also a channel, a CPT map between those state spaces. Then a theorem equivalent or very much the same as this universal recovery theorem also holds true, where now the relative entropy and the fidelity and everything else is using the appropriate definition in terms of states on von Neumann algebras. So this was a little lemma that the idea you should just have in mind is that these universal recovery results also work at the level of algebras of observables. Very good. OK, so that was the recovery stuff. So if there are more questions, I'll take them. Yes?
Is the universal recovery related to kinds of star products for quantum Bayesian inference, like the stuff that Matt Liefer and I worked on, and Poulain and Liefer have this generalized star product?
I don't know. I'd like to hear more about this, so.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear more. OK, maybe you can tell me later. Okay, so I said we were going to be talking about ADS-CFT, so let's get into that bit a little bit. So maybe to make sure we're all on the same page, I'll describe it. So ADS-CFT is this duality between two theories. One of them is a gravity theory in anti-de Sitter space, and the other is a conformal field theory in one fewer spatial dimensions. And these two theories are dual to one another. So we usually draw it like this. This is a model for anti-de Sitter space. The reason people like to think about this is because what we do is we essentially take the full universe and kind of put it in a box. That's anti-de Sitter space is kind of like that. It's like taking everything and putting it into a box. And this picture, this is time is running upward here, and space is, the perpendicular direction. And it's the gravity theory is living inside the cylinder, and the CFT, the conformal field theory, is living on the boundary of this can. The analogy is there's soup inside, which is gravity, and there's a metal can, which is supposed to be the CFT. And OK, these pictures with time can be a little bit cumbersome to draw going forward. So what I do is this is a single time slice through, pick a time, and get a time slice, and we draw it like this. So it's some hyperbolic disk. OK, so gravity living on there. And now there's a very important result in the subject, the Ryotaki-Nagi formula. I'm sure many of you are familiar, but the idea is that if you look at just a reduced subregion of the boundary, we'll call capital A throughout, you want to find its entropy, von Neumann entropy, which is the entanglement entropy of A with A complement, there should be a way to do that in the bulk using the gravity theory through this duality. Turns out what you do is you compute the the extremal surface in the bulk, or in this simple example, you just pick the fix the two endpoints and look at the geodesic that goes through between the two, that we call gamma. And the entropy is then going to be given, this the von Neumann entropy of A is given by essentially the area or the length of that, the length of the, this geodesic or the area of the extremal surface in the right units. So that's the Riitta-Kinagi formula. So when I talk about entropies throughout, that's what you should have in the back of your mind. Good. So we wanted to try to figure out what stuff in the bulk we can get in terms of just this boundary A. So it turns out you can do a little bit better. From these people, HKLL on the bottom, Hamilton, Kabat, Lifshitz, Lowe, I'll call this HKL throughout. They told us actually that you can kind of already do this. So if you have a local bulk operator sitting somewhere in the bulk, you can express that in terms of boundary data as follows. By the way, I don't know why this A is here. I think it transferred from another slide. So this is the expression that they told us, that you can take your bulk operator and you can write it in terms of operators on the boundary. These are now CFT operators, by smearing it with some function k. And that k has support essentially everywhere on the boundary outside of the light cone of the bulk operator. Okay, so this is some way of writing the bulk operator in terms of boundary data. And when I write this, well, you can question what I mean. What it really means is that you get correlation functions or expectation values, right? So the expectation of a bulk operator can instead be written in terms of a boundary, the boundary data, if I use this formula. So this is called, at least what I will call, global HKLL. Global in the sense that you're using operators on the full boundary of the CFT, the full CFT. And in fact, you can do something better. You can do something that I'll call local HKLL or causal wedge reconstruction. So here, now we're going to actually, there's the A that I wanted. Now we have our subregion A, and we're finding the minimal surface in the bulk. The causal wedge is going to be everything between those two, between the boundary subregion and its associated Riitta-Kinagi surface. And in the space-time picture, it's actually sort of the domain of dependence. So it turns out that any operator with support in this region can be written in terms of data just on A. It's a local analog of what you just saw. So like this. So anything in here can be written in terms of just the boundary A. But that'll already lead us to some questions. So from just what you've seen here, that should be, there's already enough to highlight a problem. And that problem comes, you can see it from quantum error correction. So were there questions on what I said so far? Just on the setup? Right, so here's again a picture of the CFT, the full boundary. This is some time slice. And I've partitioned it into three pieces, A1, A2, and A3. And if we put a little operator right in the center of ADS, it's outside of the causal wedge of each of these. There's no way to write this operator in terms of data just on A1 or just on A2 or just on A3. But if you take unions of those and look at A1 union A2, well, that's this full region. Its minimal surface goes here. And so the causal wedge for that union piece is now encloses this operator. But I could instead have looked at A1, A3 or A2, A3. And so there are three redundant ways of writing this operator in the boundary, in three different causal wedges. And actually, it turns out that this is exactly the same quantum error correcting code I showed you in the beginning with that triangle. It's one of these secret sharing schemes. It's like you can model this like the Q-trick code. And Almieri, Dong, and Harlow did this a while ago. It's a very, very pressing piece of work. And more generally, this is part of a phenomenon where we say that the bulk Hilbert space is really part of a code subspace of the CFT. So that's the more general phenomenon that we'll have in mind. OK, so let's come back to this HKLL question and look at some examples. So here I have here the region A is the bolded region, and then its causal wedge is that little shape. Of course, you can use causal wedge reconstruction to get anything in this region on the boundary. And the same holds true if I grow it a little bit. Or if I just take two of these that are sort of disjoint, I can just get any operator in here on this part of A and likewise there. But if you grow these regions slightly, then suddenly the calculations tell you that the minimal surface, the minimal geodesic, switches. Instead of being all the way from up here down to there, it just goes through the center. And now we already see that there's a problem. We can't use this causal wedge picture that we had before. So let me focus on this. There's the same picture again. Just to make sure we're on the same page, A is this bolded region on the boundary. It's the union of this one with this one. And I've, in dashed lines, I've shown the minimal surface for each. So the causal wedge for this picture would be the green region. And we could use causal wedge reconstruction to get everything in that green region in terms of the boundary. But if we put an operator at the center, then we don't have the tools yet. And the question is, what can we do from now? Well, you might say, well, maybe actually there's no reason why you would expect that operator to be written in terms of just stuff on A. And I would say, well, let's come back to this picture of the entropy. So the entropy of the bolded boundary region, of the entropy of A, through this Ryu Takinagi prescription, was given by the length of these geodesics, right? Plus some dots. And if you open those dots, you see that actually it depends on the entropy of the bulk fields. So if I add an excitation to the bulk field here, then the boundary entropy should be sensitive to that perturbation. More generally, the boundary reduced density matrix is sensitive to stuff that happens in this mystery region. And so somehow we need to be able to access that. And this has led to what was called the entanglement wedge hypothesis. There were actually many more hints, but that's off topic. OK. Any questions? OK. So what is the entanglement wedge? In this time slice, as I've drawn it, it's the domain of dependence of this full orange region. So that's some full space-time volume, a codimension zero volume in space-time. And the hypothesis, again, though, we'll just look at a single time slice, it makes things easier. The hypothesis is that any operator in this full entanglement wedge can be written in terms of just fields on the boundary, just boundary data. So that's what we need to show. And again, as it turns out, relative entropy becomes a useful quantity. So this is a result from the high energy literature. This is Jaffers, Lukowitz, Maldacena, and Su. And I call this JLMS. The result is that the relative entropy between two states on the boundary is equal to the relative entropy between two states in the bulk, up to some corrections in parameters from the CFT. And in general, what we do is we take n to be a large number, so this should be small. So we really do expect that these are kind of equal. But we saw that relative entropies being equal between two spaces is a sign that something is reversible, recoverable. And sure enough, that ends up being useful. So this entanglement wedge reconstruction hypothesis that I just told you was kind of proven in a sense. If you assume that this, well, actually, no, it was kind of proven. If you assume under the assumption that these two are exactly equal. So this was Shidong, Dan Harlow, and Aaron Wall. They say, suppose this is an exact equality. Then they used they essentially proved that the entanglement wedge reconstruction hypothesis holds, and their proof uses some algebraic consequences of that saturation. But you wouldn't expect that if as soon as you go away from equality to having some little tolerance, that those consequences hold. And I'll give you an example. Suppose you find a tripartite density, tripartite state that saturates strong subadditivity, then you know that state is a quantum Markov state. Now suppose you find another state that almost saturates strong subadditivity, and you can say, well, maybe that's almost a quantum Markov state. And it turns out that's not necessarily true. There can be states that are arbitrarily far away from quantum Markov states that also almost saturate strong subadditivity. And those Markov states have very nice algebraic consequences, and so you can use that to prove certain things. Likewise here, assuming this is exactly true gives you some nice consequences, but you can't actually assume that they'll hold as soon as you move away. One other thing we were lacking was an explicit expression for the reconstructed operators. And so our goal then is to prove this hypothesis robustly and find an expression that we can use. Questions? Okay, so let's come back to this. So remember, JLMS. JLMS was the fact that relative entropy between bulk and boundary are essentially the same. And remember also that universal recovery maps tell you that you can recover. So what we are going to do is we're not going to assume that these are exactly the same. We're going to say that these corrections are important. And there's also other evidence that I won't mention here that in fact you can't, we don't expect these to be exactly equal for both reasons on the gravity side and also some new reasons on the quantum information side. But it's maybe take my word for it for now that we expect this to be only an approximate equality, that these are not zero. Great, so we expect that we can actually recover. And so here's this will be our strategy. The goal will be to suppose that we have a quantum channel from bulk to boundary. So that's a map from states in the bulk to states in the boundary. We're going to find its recovery map, which will then be a map from on states from boundary to bulk. You then compute its adjoint, which is a map from operators in the bulk to operators in the boundary. And now because the relative entropy is preserved, we know that this map is going to work well. So that's what we need. We needed a map from operators in the bulk to operators in the boundary that works well. And that's the strategy. Okay, so is that clear, the strategy? Very good. Right, so here are the actual assumptions. The first thing we'll assume is that there's a quantum channel from bulk to boundary. And this is the toy version. I'll show you the bigger one later. So pretend there's an isometry from the code space in the
bulk into the CFT.
So that takes the full code space into the full CFT. And then we partial trace over a bar, the region we don't want. Okay? So we're assuming that's one assumption. The second assumption is that this relative entropy condition holds, and that's been shown by other authors. And now a zeroth order one that I'm only putting on here for the sake of showing this clearly on the slides is that we assume that the code space factorizes, and we assume that the CFT factorizes across the partition shown by the bold. But you should not expect that to actually be true in ADS CFT. We don't expect that to be true. For example, if you have gauge fields, they don't really respect this kind of factorization. And so I've only put this here just for simplicity. We don't assume this in the work, and I'll come back to that point later on. So with the assumption, again, the assumption being that the quantum channel is the one that takes the full code space to the boundary and then trace over the region you don't want, and the other assumption being that the relative entropy holds, we're going to progress. But there's a problem. The problem is that, I'm going to use this. The problem is that this relative entropy condition we have tells you that the relative entropy between two states just on the entanglement wedge, reduced to the entanglement wedge, is preserved when you look at just the corresponding states on the region A. And the monotonicity of relative entropy, what we need to use those recovery theorems, shouldn't have this extra quantum channel. It should just be two states are preserved under a single map. And here we have this extra partial trace. So what we need to do to get around this is we do something called, we introduce what we call the local channel, where you start with a state restricted to the entanglement wedge, the smaller space, append some ancilla from the other side, and then what you have is a channel from little a to capital A that respects monotonicity of relative entropy according to this proof. So the next step then will be to find the recovery map for what we call T, the local channel, and then we'll have to show that it also works for N. So the recovery map for T we already have, you just take that integrated expression that I showed you earlier, so that gives us that recovery map.
Sorry, yes. Is the trace of the state like N, is it important?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And you'll see why when we get to the algebraic setting later. Okay, so good. So we're going to find this recovery map and show that it still works for N. And indeed it does. So the proof is simple. You can look at the one norm between these states, you use Pinsker's inequality, and this second inequality comes from the relative entropy again. But the short answer is that the recovery map for this local channel T also works well for N. And so what we've done is we've succeeded in finding a map that takes states in the bulk, the states on the boundary to the states in the bulk with high fidelity. It reverses the bulk to boundary map. Okay, so we've essentially done it. So here we have our favorite little bulk operator living in the entanglement wedge. And we want to find its version on the boundary. So we have our recovery map, our universal recovery channel. And remember that this depends on a particular choice of reference state. I mean, this N was important because that's the bulk to boundary map, but this reference state is, it gives us a family. So we're free to choose a reference state. And if you make the following choice, you choose it to be the maximally mixed state on the code subspace, then all of the equations simplify greatly. And in particular, what we find is the following final answer, that starting with this phi A in the bulk, the boundary version on just capital A, that's this, is computed by taking the applying the adjoint of the recovery map to phi A. That's the answer. So what is this? I have some words, but I don't have great intuition. So the words are that what you do is you take your bulk reference state and perturb it in the direction of the operator you care about. What you're doing then is you're looking at the response of the modular Hamiltonian to that perturbation. And the modular Hamiltonian is just defined to be essentially the log of the density matrix. So in this case, you perturb the bulk state in the direction of the bulk operator. And to find the reconstructed boundary operator, you see how the boundary modular Hamiltonian responds to that perturbation. So I don't have any intuition for this. If somebody has more physical intuition, I'd be happy to hear it. But
what is J?
Right. So J was the bulk to full code space to boundary mapping. In this case, I should also mention that some people like to think of this as just a subspace of the CFT. So that in that case, this would just be an embedding, but an encoding. So let me just copy this again here. So there it is. Okay, so that's the answer. You could unpack this if you want. You could have written this out in the integrated expression, and there it is. So in this expression, what you do is you take your bulk operator, map it to the boundary with that bulk to boundary map, throw away the bits that you don't want, and then you have to do this modular evolution on the boundary. And this thing here is what is the reconstructed operator. You could also say that, well, maybe I don't know how to push this, but instead what you could do is you could use the global HKLL, if you remember something, write it in terms of the full CFT, as long as you then also project it onto the code space. Okay. Now, what we also then showed is that you can compute two-point functions. So suppose you have some composite operator, some phi A prime in the bulk. You could push this composite operator with just R star with the reconstruction. You can find the reconstruction of that composite thing on the boundary. That's hard. You might instead prefer to push this one to the boundary and separately push this one to the boundary and hope that that two-point function is the same. It turns out that it is, actually. The approximation comes from the fact that relative entropies are only approximate, but the two-point functions work. Sadly, that's only for two-point functions. And this is an open problem. So in the exact case, when we know that the relative entropies are exactly equal, this R star, this map that takes bulk operators to boundary operators, is an algebra homomorphism, meaning that you can push, if you have some large endpoint function, you can push individual operators to the boundary, and then the correlation function will work. But in the approximate case, that's not true. We were only able to show this for two-point functions. So this remains an open question, actually. Right, so now if you remember, I said that we had this assumption that we don't actually need.
But theoretically, the value of epsilon is 1 by n.
Say again?
Epsilon, when you do the recovery, the difference of
yes.
Then it's because it's log of epsilon, so theoretically the...
Log of epsilon.
Fidelity was, I thought,
Okay, so the relative entropy distance is small.
I should put epsilon equals to 1 over n.
Maybe you have to go back a bit farther. Like the maybe I can just point here. The I think it goes the right way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just my question is that. If the epsilon is just 1 over n, and if I take log of them, it's actually the
if epsilon is 1, you take log, so you get 0. So it tells you the fidelity would be, or sorry.
So the scaling with n is not that good.
With n as in the CFT n. In the fidelity, you mean?
No, not the
trace distance. Oh, okay. Actually, okay. The fidelity, I think, goes like exponential in 1 over n.
Okay.
Right from here.
I don't.
From here. Like, so this goes like 1 over n. So the left-hand side is 1 over n, goes like 1 over n, and then the right-hand side is log. So to get the fidelity, it's the exponential.
Okay.
Okay, so there's this assumption that we don't actually need. And the way we get around this is using algebras of observables. So we disband with the starting point of just Hilbert spaces. We say, okay, suppose that there's we just use finite dimensional but Neumann algebras, which, again, is, to remind you, it's just a set of operators that are closed under addition, multiplication, self-adjoint, and have the identity. I guess there was a reference here that I was talking to David about. That's the reference you might want there. So what we do is we start with these von Neumann algebras and state spaces on them. So here's the picture. We have an algebra of observables on the code space, and a subalgebra of those restricted to the entanglement wedge. And there's an algebra of observables for the CFT and a subalgebra restricted to the boundary subregion. And the map, the bulk to boundary map, was just this quantum channel N, or sorry, J. Our goal then was to find this R star, the map that takes observables in the entanglement wedge to observables on the boundary. So that was the goal. And the assumptions that these are the only two actual assumptions. You would just need to assume that there's some quantum channel from states on the code on the code algebra to states on the CFT, and that the correct generalization of relative entropies to algebras is also preserved. That this channel J preserves the relative entropy between bulk and boundary. And this subscript here really means that you start with a state on a full algebra and then restrict it to a subalgebra. So here, this row A, you take a state on the full code space, restrict it to the subalgebra on the entanglement wedge, and this is what we need to be true. So now using that little lemma I showed earlier, this is the final answer in terms of the algebraic language. Let's look at it here again. I guess Benny's gone, but this is why that expression, the log expression, is nice, because it looks like it's a perturbation of this Hamiltonian. On the other hand, you see now there was sort of no embedding. That maybe you can see it later, that the fiducial state that we append just comes from extending states to a larger algebra. So right, so then I guess the main point then, let's see if that's something else here. Maybe I want to actually show you a very busy slide. So the reason it looks busy is because I'm just taking it straight from the paper. So here I've blown it up again. So this was the actual theorem we prove. We assume, right, you just want to assume that there are these von Neumann algebras and that this relative entropy condition holds. And then we show that a collection of things are true, one of which is that the recovery map works well. Another is that you can get operators on the boundary. This is number two, is the entanglement wedge reconstruction. And the third one is showing that two-point functions can be computed in the way that you'd like. And it's this third one that we weren't able to actually generalize to higher point functions. And of course, for the high energy people, this is the final answer in terms of the algebraic language. But I prefer actually this expression here because it clarifies things. So you can think of it as take your operator, push it to the boundary, and then evolve it with the modular Hamilton or with modular evolution. Okay, so with that, maybe I'll actually just leave up the summary and then just leave some time for questions. Thanks.
Can you go back to your previous slide?
Pardon me?
Can you go back to the previous slide?
This one?
Yes.
Yeah.
So phi gets pushed, you're using global H kernel as J.
At the moment, we're just, all we said was that there was some bulk to boundary quantum channel. But the thing I said a little earlier, that's my mouse. There it is. You can use global HKLL, provided you also then add these projectors onto the code space. Right, so for us, this J was just some quantum channel from states in the full code space to states in the boundary. The full bulk to boundary map. And you can, if you're not sure how to use that, you can use the global HKLL, but you have to add these projectors. Because then, you know, that's what this expression is just algebraically equal to. So you can use it.
But effectively it gets spread out over the entire boundary. Is that true? Projectors are projected onto low energy subspaces, right?
Yes, yeah. and then we still have this partial trace though. And in the algebraic expression, which I'll just point up here, instead of the partial trace, what it becomes is a restriction to the subalgebra of observables on it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So you have a slide where you have the kind of observables on one side and states on the other side.
Yes. Yes, let me pull it up.
So I was a bit confused about why this distinction is important. If I'm in a finite dimensional over space, then you know the algebra generated by the states is the same as the algebra generated by the observables. And the problem really is, you know, you've got this mapping, which is noisy, and you need to recover from that. And so
right. That's
why we're using recovery maps. But it sounded like there was some importance to, you know, making the switch from states to observables was somehow...
No, I don't think so, actually. It's just for presentation. I mean, you're right that, like, we can say that the states on this algebra are kind of the same as the algebra itself. There's just, you know, you can write it as the intersection. Is that what you were talking about, I guess?
Or they generate the algebra.
Sure, yes, right.
So if I know how something acts on a full set of states, I know how it acts on any operator.
Right. The only reason I was making this distinction was because the theorem starts by saying that there's a map between the states on algebras. And starting from that, I showed the picture this way because it makes it a little easier to digest when I say, okay, what we want is an operator, is a map from operators to operators, but the way we get that is from first taking the, like ADS CFT gives us a map from states to states. And what you're, I guess what you're saying is that, well, it also kind of gives you a map from operators to operators. But that I wouldn't know how to write down. I think people might take issue with that. Like,
what's wrong with just saying whatever operator you want, you know, write it as a linear combination of states. And there, you know, act your J map on that operator, and you know how it acts on the states.
But then how would you use this, the recovery results in that case? Because that would just sort of give you the answer. You would say, I guess what you're saying is true, but you wouldn't have an explicit form. Like this way, if you're saying, okay, there's a map that you can take this, and you could write that as a linear combination of these operators in boundary. But you don't know what combination, I guess. Is that not?
Well, I think the easy thing is just, you know, writing any operator as a linear combination of states in that same space. So, you know, any bulk observable is really just a linear combination of bulk states and similarly the boundary. So if I have a way of mapping between this complete set of states, I have a way of mapping between observables. So it just seemed to me that the districting states and observables was unimportant, that all the hard work was in figuring out what the mapping is.
Yeah. I don't know that I have a good answer for you off the top of my head, but I'm confident that with a bit more thought I would come up with one.
What about the infinite dimensional case, though, where it really does?
Yeah, so the infinite dimensional case, there would, I guess, be a distinction. Sadly, we don't have anything to say about that yet. We expect that these results would go through, but no way of proving it just yet. But there, I guess, there would be a distinction between the operators and states. And in fact, yeah, here we used the fact, we kind of used that definition, really, because it was finite dimensional. Yeah, maybe I'll think about this and come back to you.
Can you expand on what went wrong or what the obstruction was when you thought about higher point functions?
It's a bit technical, actually. So what we did was we used this Schwarz inequality kind of twice. So the way the proof went is you use this twice, and then a polarization type of identity to write one correlation function just in terms of things that are known. But the problem was that we didn't have something that was like a version of this for more operators. It was only kind of for two that we were able to do this. But it is a bit technical, so I'd be happy to show you. But intuition wise, I don't think if you can imagine, we started having something. We started trying to prove it for four, but then it just breaks down. The proof doesn't go through. That doesn't mean that it's not possible, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Just our proof failed. Essentially because we didn't have a version of this for more operators.
Can you show, for example, that 4.5, that in some limit 4-point functions factorize into products of 2-point functions?
Or I mean,
is that also not possible?
One limit you could take would be like the n goes to infinity limit where everything becomes exact. So in the exact case, you can, for an arbitrary high point function, you can take each operator, push it to the boundary with its own recovery map, and then take the correlation function. It's only in the approximate case that things broke down in the proof. So in one limit that you could choose is where everything becomes perfect and exact, and then it works. But that's a limit that we argued pretty strongly you shouldn't take.
So basically, is part of the point that when it's approximate, you cannot push the operators to the boundary separately, but you have to do some sort of together pushing?
Well, you can push them separately as long as you only care about no more than two.
Ah.
And maybe more, but you'd have to prove it first.
So going right back to the beginning of your talk,
yeah.
You made this comparison between classical recovery and quantum recovery.
Right.
And so this Bayesian classical recovery operation you described is the analog of the Petz recovery. So that Bayesian recovery you described is not optimal recovery for a classical channel. Optimal recovery would be, you know, for a given y that I observe the output, calculate which x was the most likely to have been the input and report that x.
Mm-hmm.
If I instead say sample x randomly from p of x given y, I'm adding noise relative to that optimal scheme. So this, to my mind, has always been, you know, by the analogy, a clear indication that Petz recovery map is far from optimal because it's not even optimal in the classical case.
Right.
Is the universal recovery meant to be some sort of analog of the proper, like the actual optimal classical recovery scheme where you compute the maximal likelihood? I mean, you obviously couldn't do exactly that, but is there any sense in which it's an analog of the optimal classical recovery scheme?
I mean, again, because the universal one reduces to the regular Petz map on the code space, they're kind of the same in that context. So be surprised if one was much stronger than the other. You know what I mean?
No, exactly. So
like so have your favorite quantum channel and then compute the PETS map for that,
yep.
And then compute the universal PETS map. They are, as long as you only care about states on the code space, they're the same.
I see. So that sounds like it. So there was some work by John Tyson showing how in certain circumstances you can do better than the PETS recovery map.
Uh-huh.
So unrelated to this classical analogy we just talked about. But so it seems to me like you could probably do better than this universal recovery operation. It would probably only make a difference in terms of the approximation. Like you'd get a better approximation than the one you have.
Yeah. That's interesting.
But I don't think it's optimal.
But does this also, by the way, answer Rob's question about whether or not you saturate that?
Yeah.
I guess that maybe does. Like this maybe doesn't saturate, and there are better...
Well, I don't think it's about saturation, because it could be that the optimal one is, you know, saturates some other inequality.
Right.
So it's just not clear whether the performance of the optimal one can be expressed in that simple way in terms of the fidelity and the trace distance.
Right.
So I'm not sure it quite bears on that question.
Okay, fair enough. But your question, that's interesting. I would actually be happy to see that if there was something that gave me a better quality approximation. Because then, I mean, everything that we've done, these correlation functions are, everything that you compute is only kind of approximate. And if anything you can do to bring the error down would be great, especially as people try to prove these prove on the high energy side, prove these things to higher and higher orders. It would be good to keep up.
Is the scaling of the approximation a problem for you at all? Like, is there any place where you say, only if we had a better approximation?
No, not for me, I think. But still, it would be nice to keep it as small as possible.
Well, I think it might be actually in the higher point functions, because what Ronak reminded me of is that, you know, in the large N, the leading order, the higher point functions are just two-point functions.
Right.
But what we're really trying to find are sort of the higher order corrections to that.
Right.
Those are the real interactions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I'm wondering if somehow you are doing, quote unquote, the right thing for what you're doing, which is reproducing sort of the simple two-point functions, and that you're not quite, with this map, going to be able to go high enough in 1 over n to sort of see.
Yeah, I mean, again, like,
I'm not sure.
The way we analyze the endpoint functions did not depend on the explicit form of the map in any way.
Yeah.
So if we had a better map, maybe, you know, the approximation would be even better, but we'd still need a new proof technique, I think. Or just be smarter and better with our technique. But I think at least the current problem with computing these did not boil down to the fact that the approximation wasn't great.
Okay.
It was the fact, because it doesn't rely on details of the map at all. You just suppose you have one of these recovery maps, and it works well with some small epsilon that you don't make any claim about, and it still failed at higher than it failed at 3 and 4. Questions? Okay. Yes, thanks.